minutes, 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, condescending liberals who just want to be part of something bigger than themselves. Good morning to you. You know who you are. I'm talking directly to you, one guy or two. Kimo Savi, right? Dan Ingram says.
Oh,
hey, how are you, Mark?
How you doing, man?
Or maybe that was Arthur Gottfried.
No. That was definitely Dan Ingram.
Hey, right on, man. So, Mark Riley is here with me. Kalo, the Costco ho, is here with me. Clutch Larson in the booth. P.W. McDonald on his way down. Pashman, son of Lewis and Linda Pashman, that is Dan, is running around somewhere. We are all here, and, you know, we've been watching the television. We've been with, you know, bated breath. You know, talking about the arcane meeting the modern, CNN has a chimney cam. All right, there is a small cam. If you're watching CNN, just in case you miss the smoke, the entire world is watching a chimney, and not even a particularly nice chimney. You'd think the Vatican would, you know, maybe doll up the chimney if we're all going to look at it. If people from around the world are going to be looking at a chimney, you know, do a little something with it. You know, update it a little bit.
It's the papal chimney. You know, just okay, a few minutes ago, not even 10 minutes ago, the black smoke came out for the second time.
2 days of black smoke, so you can relax. You can take your eyes off the chimney. It's going to be a few hours now.
Looks like Cardinal Ratzinger is not the lock everybody said he was going in, huh?
Well, maybe he is. I'm sure there's all sorts of strange politicking going on. We're trying to get a guy on the inside over there.
Really?
Yeah, we're trying to get a guy on the inside. And we got connections, you know, because Milfington, Cardinal Milfington.
Oh, okay.
He's pretty tight with one of the guys on the inside, one of the group of cardinals that's making the decision. And we're trying to plant a mini disc or some sort of mic on him. So maybe we'll have that, you know, tomorrow or the next day, depending on how long it takes to actually choose the new pope.
Well, you know, they some people in the media, some of our colleagues, Marin, our brethren and sistren, I guess, have been kind of handicapping this like it's the Derby.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, well, you know, here's the guy from Nigeria, his odds are,
yeah.
And here's Ratzinger, his odds are, I think his odds were going out at 7-2.
We'll just get Johnny K Street in here and figure that out.
Figure that out, really.
In lieu of real news, apparently, that's worth covering to these people, they'll sit and speculate about, you know, marginally known cardinals. To a mass of people that just want a new guy, that just want to watch that chimney. I was up a little later than I should have been, Mark Riley, because I had that horrible moment you have when you live in New York City and you come home and out in front of your apartment building is one of those giant trash cargo crates, the kind that they leave there by a truck.
A dumpster.
Yeah, but, you know, the big guy, dumpster. The kind, the size of a semi.
Yeah.
When you see one of those sitting in front of your building, you're like, wow, how long am I not going to sleep for? And I saw my super, and I'm like, what's up? What's going to fill that? You know, what are we doing? Are we doing roof work? Are we gutting an entire apartment? And he goes, no, it's for garbage. And I'm like, for garbage?
Garbage? When was the last time your garbage was collected? The 80s?
And they collect every day. And I'm like, I mean, and every day I see stuff out there. I see bookshelves. I see, you know, lamps. I see, you know, beds and stuff. And I'm like, where's this garbage from? Dude, they filled it up. I don't know where it came from.
Oh, I'll tell you where it came from. It must have come from a couple, three apartments that have just recently come vacant.
Right.
Either they evicted somebody, somebody died, or somebody moved on and left a whole bunch of stuff. So they're cleaning this stuff out because they're getting ready to renovate those apartments and charge twice as much as you're paying to rent them out.
Well, that's what they did to the dead lady's apartment next door. They gutted that thing. They cleaned it out in like, you know, inside a month. It looks beautiful. I mean, granted, you know, my landlord's Dominican, so it's relative to, you know,
oh, here we go now.
That the extreme sensibility, you know, that I mean, if
are you
like,
saying the Dominican sensibility is relative?
No, I'm saying that if you like tiles on the ceiling of the bathroom,
hey!
You're gonna like it. It's pretty exotic.
You can play drums in a room like that. Have a good time. Like
you know, my taste is very stripped down. You know, I just know that, you know, I grew up with this sort of jappy, not my mother, but, you know, in the world of middle-class Jewishness, there's a kind of, you know, jappy sensibility, a little gaudy, you know, Dominican. Dominican is a different kind of gaudy.
Ah, yes.
When I moved into my apartment, which was my landlord's apartment previous to mine, there was a chandelier, Riley, that hung in the hallway. The one in my bedroom was the beauty.
This thing, you had a chandelier.
There was a chandelier in the bedroom that hung down, had four panels of glass with parrots on it.
All right?
Etched parrots on the glass. And I took it down because, you know, my wife and I were like, I can't sleep under that thing, you know. And we put it in the box, and we put it out in the yard, out behind the building, not to throw it away, but just to set it there. And Carlos, my landlord, goes, "What's he doing?" And I'm like, I'm putting that out back. He goes, "That's mine." And I'm like, "Well, don't take it.
Here, it's all yours.
It's very nice, but."
Next thing you know, it's in his bedroom.
Now he's got the dentist office downstairs. And I even had half the thought, Riley, to say, "Well, this is practical for me. Maybe I can get my teeth cleaned." Then I realized I've given this guy a little bit of grief over the last couple of years. I don't want to be in a marathon man situation. Yeah. Is it safe? Yes, very safe.
When they come at you with them 9-inch needles, there's a problem.
I better stick with my other dentist in the city.
Yeah, it's only Novocaine. Don't worry, it's a big needle, but it's only Novocaine.
I saw this Harris poll that said George Bush's ratings down to 44%, the lowest of his term. He's running, you know, just slightly ahead of Bin Laden at this point. I mean, that's pretty low, and I'm happy about it.
Well, you know, if you wanted to put this in a papal context, how much black smoke would there be around George Bush's policies
if there was
a conclave actually passing judgment on them?
Yeah, I'm happy. You know, that I'm happy that there's a little bit of sway, that there's a little bit, you know, that people are starting to wake up and realize that even Republicans, that he's not the guy that they thought he was, and that they sort of buckled to a lot of fear. There's also something I want to apologize for, is that I did some research, Riley.
Yes, I know.
And, you know, I guess I'm guilty of being a little obnoxious and flying off the handle a little bit. But the organization Responsible Wealth, and we spoke to a representative from this organization or somebody who was involved with it last week, that didn't really give a full picture of what this does, of what Responsible Wealth does. But I did a little research yesterday because I want action to be taken. I want taxes to be fair. I don't want them to repeal the estate tax. You know, I want corporate responsibility. And the woman we talked to, and I don't need to bring up her name because I don't remember her name, did not give us a full sense of what it was. And I started talking about, you know, there's a difference between charity and really, you know, creating some systemic change within the tax situation, the tax system. And someone called us, this guy Ray, a clergyman, and said, I'm part of Responsible Wealth, and I think you should reinvestigate. And I got to be honest with you, you go to responsiblewealth.org, and they are an amazing organization. They advocate fair taxes. They support a living wage for all. They want greater corporate accountability. They promote a broadened asset ownership for all Americans. And they're sort of doing something that's interesting. I hope that they can facilitate some systemic change, but my initial reaction to them was essentially a gut reaction without doing a lot of investigation, and I am now doing it, and I'm not going to apologize.
Now
I'm going to pull a Rush Limbaugh, you know. I'm not going to apologize for what I said, because I don't do that. No, of course I do that. You know, I apologize for misrepresenting Responsible Wealth, and they didn't get to me. It's not like something like I was asleep last night, and they were just like, "Hey,
Mark.
You're in trouble, kids. Yeah. You know who you're dealing with here? We got money. We can put
some people right out in front of your building.
Right. You see that dumpster? That's never leaving until you get on the air. We're going to be throwing stuff off of your roof for the next 6 months." Well, anyways, they did fill the dumpster, and it was done by about 8:30, 9 o'clock, but that's a little later than I like to stay up sometimes, but I was glad that it was done. There were speakers. There was stuff from the 1940s going into that dumpster.
Really?
Yeah, these speakers that look like joke speakers. You remember in the 70s that there was a...
I know. Yeah, the plasterboard speakers.
Well, the cheap ones that were trying to keep up with the new hi-fi things.
Yeah.
These cheap ones would be all speaker, right? But they wouldn't be quality, but they'd be about 9 feet tall. There was a set of those in there.
Oh, yeah, and a big woofer that splits the minute you play anything loud.
Like an explosive, flatile. Is that the word? Flatus? Flatile?
All you need to know about that dumpster outside is that it means money to your landlord. Because he's paying money to have it put out there. He's going to make all of that money back and a whole heck of a lot more the minute he rents out those apartments.
The dude's making big changes, man. I even bullied him into having an exterminator come once a month, which he's supposed to have anyways.
Yeah, wait till you see your next rental bill.
Oh, yeah.
Or your new lease. Here we go.
The rent stabilized, dude. What can he do?
Oh, you're stabilized?
Sure.
So what's that, 4.4%?
I think they can do it a little more. It used to be like 3 point or 2 point something, but now it's up a little more per year. But I signed a 2-year lease. That's why I'm still
there. Oh, you're cool. You're in good shape there.
All right, so when we come back, let's Karl Rove made some statements yesterday.
What a weasel this guy is.
Counteract some truth. The statements counteract the truth, which is par for the course with this bunch of neocon freaks. We'll be back and talk about that 16 past the hour. Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Evaluate for 30 days. Call now. 1-800-900-2657. That's 1-800-900-2657.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. You know, Karl Rove is whining. He's whining. He's whining a little bit about the media's approach to government. Like, he hasn't frightened enough media outlets into doing, you know, puppy stories or staring at chimneys for 6 hours. Unbelievable. And this is all in response. Well, not all in response to, but, you know, there is a lie at the core of some of what Rove is saying, obviously. And let's track this live from this statement from George Bush, January 25th of 2005.
Mr. President, do you think it's a proper use of government funds to pay commentators to promote your policies?
No.
Are you going to order that?
Therefore, I will not pay you to.
Are you ordering that there be an end to that
practice? Yes, I am. I expect my cabinet secretaries to make sure that practice doesn't go forward. There needs to be independence. And Mr. Armstrong Williams admitted he made a mistake. And we didn't know about this in the White House. And, you know, there needs to be a nice independent relationship between the White House and the press and the administration and the press.
All right, well, it's been proven, as some of you know, because this story's been out there for a little while, that he was lying, that the White House did know about it, because the contract to renew the renewal of Armstrong Williams' contract came up, and it was discussed. And a lower-level White House operative, a staff member, you know, discussed it with somebody and said, okay, we're going to renew this contract. So it was renewed. The White House knew about the Armstrong Williams propaganda contract. Now, the question of whether, you know, we want state-funded propaganda, that's against the law.
Well, it's against the law, and, you know, Karl Rove talking about we're substituting the shrill and rapid call of the track announcer for calm judgment, fact, and substance would seem to fly in the face of anyone in the administration, whether it's Rod Paige or George Bush, paying Armstrong Williams. Now, it was interesting that the president said, well, Armstrong Williams has admitted he made a mistake. What, he made a mistake by accepting the money? Is that the mistake he made? Obviously, he knew there was a conflict. He knew that he was treading a very thin line there. He's admitted that much. But what about the culpability of the people that didn't see that there was a line that was crossed here? Because obviously, Rod Paige in his office didn't think there was any problem with paying Armstrong Williams $250,000 to promote No Child Left Behind. And then how did they think that money was going to end up being earned? I mean, did they think he was just going to stand on the corner and hand out flyers?
Well, I think they obviously, you know, and I know you know this too, is that, you know, they knew exactly what they were doing, and they took a shot at doing it. They bought this guy. He did what they paid him to do, which was disperse propaganda as a relatively legitimate news person, and they got busted.
Well, it's interesting that there are a lot of these relatively legitimate news people, whether it's Armstrong, whether it's Jeff Gannon. I know he would get real upset.
Maybe I should rephrase that. People who present themselves as journalists, you know, there's just such a fine line where anybody, you know, with a microphone, a camera, and internet access, you know, can be, you know, present themselves as a legitimate news person, because people don't hold them, they don't take them to task. If somebody, a regular person, sees someone on TV saying, I'm here at the White House and I'm reporting, then they're like, oh, the news guy.
Oh, yeah. And see, this is what's disingenuous about, you know, Karl Rove speaking in Washington College. By the way, that's in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday, talking about, you know, the media approach to covering government. The bottom line is he has exploited and his people have been the beneficiaries of the very same media coverage that he now decries. I guess he figures since Bush has won his second term, he doesn't really have to worry about any of this anymore. So now he can come out and act as though he's against certain things the media does, which have obviously been to his benefit in the recent past. That's the amazing thing.
Well, what's interesting is a couple things that are interesting here. I'm quoting Karl Rove from this speech yesterday. What really gets me is how short the time horizon is for many members of the media of coming to a conclusion of whether something will pass. And I guess that's about, you know, legislation.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of look at it in a broader way as to whether something will pass out of the collective consciousness. See, you know, they've been very successful at bullying the media, like with the Dan Rather memo. You know, that things will stay in the media if they keep pressuring and putting information out, the media will cover it. So they have been able to determine how long things that they want to stay in the collective conscious will stay. And if it serves their agenda, it will stay in the collective consciousness. Am I right?
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. And this is a strategy, we're going to talk about this later, that Tom DeLay is in the process of using. He understands that he's gotten a whole bunch of bad publicity, and he's moving to try and deal with that. And for Rove to act as though now he's suddenly above all this is absolutely absurd. I hope these college kids know a little better than this.
What are you kidding? They know what people tell them, and there's a few of them that know different. You know, I think that there is some hope out there for young people. But, you know, Rove's, you know, the nads on this guy, you know, that he has stones big enough to say, you know, to really even bring up, apparently, that he brought up the No Child Left Behind Act.
Okay? Yeah, he did.
And he said it was stalled in Congress at every step before its passage. And he's somehow tying that in with blaming, you know, the media somehow. Whereas, like, you know, Armstrong Williams, he's sitting right on it. He hired a media representative to present propaganda supporting No Child Left Behind, and it failed.
Well, yeah, and see, well, what's interesting is the legislation ended up passing, and one of the things that they were looking to do with Armstrong Williams very specifically was to build support in black communities for No Child Left Behind, because Bush had, you know, put this veneer on the outside of it that it was going to help with the education of black young people. Well, it hasn't accomplished that particular goal, no matter how much money they gave Armstrong Williams.
And that's just it. They failed. So, you know, the Karl Rove, I can quote him, he said the press corps is, quote, less liberal than it is oppositional, end quote, which means they oppose, you know, what we're trying to put out as propaganda. And they shouldn't fight us on what we decide truth is.
Well, you know, the other thing, he is just, look, the press is out to make money. All right, let's be very clear. The media in this country is profit-driven media, and Karl Rove has known that since the day he could talk. So the idea that there's some fair and balanced objective that everybody's going for is just nonsense.
Well, he knows that. I know. Of course he knows that. He's the designer. He's the mastermind of the evil genius of propaganda. But when we come back, we're going to talk about how this filters into the Iraq situation, because not only are news outlets not covering much of what's going on in Iraq, the troops aren't even reporting things where people aren't killed, so the information is being stopped at that level. That's heavy.
That is deep. We'll come back to it on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
I'm selling, you know, underwear on Orchard Street in the middle of August all day. You know,
right? Randy Rose on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, Mark Maron here on Air America Radio's Morning Edition with Mark Riley.
Hi.
So let's move on. Let's get into this. Let's do this thing. Hey, what's Kayla? What's the matter with you? You upset, man? You upset? What do you got on your mind? What happened? Did the baseball team lose? What happened?
No. My Mets did lose, however, but I'm definitely not upset by
it. You feel okay, man? You feeling loose? You feeling good?
I'm feeling really good. I'm craving the chicken I have leftovers from last night. I went to Junior's.
All right, let me get this straight. So I'm sitting here thinking you might be in a bad mood, but you're sitting here thinking about the food that's in your refrigerator from a restaurant from last night.
Yes.
From Junior's in downtown Brooklyn. You didn't get no cheesecake?
Junior's
cheesecake. Yes, I had a slice of cheesecake.
You walk in there, it's literally that the walls are decorated. decorated with
the raw sweat cheesecake.
It's all about the cheesecake there.
Yeah. They also, by the way, have the worst waiters on the East Coast.
Well, that's par for the course.
Sorry, they just do.
Deli waiters are supposed to be that way. If a deli waiter, a classic New York deli waiter, is not doing his job, if you don't feel like you're imposing on him.
What do you want?
You know, when you're sitting there going, I'm afraid to ask him for more mustard. You know, if you don't
you
have
want that, more mustard?
I'm sorry. Can I just get a? All right. Okay. Don't hurt yourself. You know, there's only a couple of good delis left though. The Carnegie. You know, it's weird what's happened with New York delis, and obviously I'm not eating meat anymore. And I feel like I paid for some sort of strange sin. Because I transgressed. I had a relapse down south on my vegetarianism, and I ate alligator because I thought that reptile didn't count as meat. That it was I thought reptile was some secret, you know what I mean? That they don't farm them.
Yes, they do.
They farm the alligators.
I think they got gator farms someplace.
The entire area is a gator farm, apparently.
Well, yeah, that could be true, too.
And then let me just say to my mother, Mom, if you're out running, be careful. Will you? Watch for the gators. Okay, that's not the way that I want you to go. Do you understand? And I assume that you've been running long enough, and I know that you're probably, you know, bouncing along the little path in your little, community down there, whatever, the little enclave, the gated world of condos that you live in. And just be careful, Mom. That's all I'm saying. And I love you. So let's move on. Now that I did that, just I'm telling my mother to watch out for alligators.
There you go.
Where was I going with that? Oh, as far as delis goes. Now you got to look for which place has what you like. You know, like I still think Second Avenue Deli has the best pastrami. I think the Carnegie Deli still has the best brisket. But there are things at each place that are sort of lacking. So you got to decide what you want if you're coming to New York.
Yes, you're absolutely right, and go for it.
I've never been to Sammy's Romanian. My sin.
I have.
My problem.
I've been to Sammy's. Sammy's is more than just food. Let's just put it that way.
They got schmaltz on the table.
They got strolling musicians, for God's sake.
Well, that's nice, but, you know, when you're still putting chicken fat on the table, it's sort of like, come to Sammy's and die. Why prolong it longer than necessary?
Order the big steak.
Yeah, but they were schmaltz. I mean, you know, who uses schmaltz anymore? But it's nice. You got to respect the old ways.
Hey, let me tell you something. You can't get in that place on weekends, you know.
I got to go when I relapse completely. I'm not going to now. Oh, there's Jim Earl in the booth now.
Lord.
He's like the
Veggie Man.
The saint of vegetarianism.
Saint Jim.
He's doing the classic stretch sign. Yeah. That's the one thing you don't want to see as a comic is them pulling their hands together like they're kneading a pizza dough. It means like the other guy's not ready to go on yet. We haven't dropped the checks. Now he's giving me the rap sign.
Yeah.
How about these two signs? How about that, Jim? You recognize these two fingers? You get that? All right, Cardinal Father Mort Jim Earl. So let's talk about this. What's going on now? And you would think that this would have been the case months ago. Is that Iraq has now risen to the top of the list of places where you just don't want to do business. All right,
yeah.
They say it's the worst place in the world to open up a business. So if you're thinking about that Starbucks franchise or maybe opening a McDonald's of some kind or a sneaker place, not the time to do it. Now, and I don't want to belittle this. Okay, since last year, Iraq has shot from fifth place in the rankings with 2,922 terror incidents recorded in the 12 months to February 2005. It is now number one, and there are several others on the list. But I want to focus on Iraq because we've had some other stories coming out of Iraq that really counter. They counter the news that the administration is trying to put out, that there is a tremendous amount of success and things are moving forward. Now, along the same lines as this risk for businesses is that the reconstruction, Riley, is being destroyed. That you can't, they are not making any real headway in sewage, water.
Well, because they're diverting their resources and their time to one. End goal, Mark. And you talked about this during the break. What they're getting ready to do is to start sending American troops home, which Americans, of course, love. But in order to deal with that, they've got to have trained Iraqi troops. So what they're doing is not having Americans going out and engaging the insurgency. What they're doing is having these American troops, more and more of them, train Iraqi troops. Now, what does that mean? That means the more Iraqi troops Americans are training, remember, some of our allies are supposed to be training these troops, too. Nobody knows how that's going right now. But the more American troops that are training Iraqi troops, the more money that's supposed to go for infrastructure, the money that's supposed to go for sewage systems, power plants, getting people water, All of that is now being pushed over into security.
But it, right, and it also suggests that this free market utopia that the neocon death cult had in mind when they went into this venture has broken apart, that they cannot stop many of the insurgent attacks on pipelines, on oil refineries, on facilities that are needed for public works, and that businesses outside of Iraq are and businesses that are willing to come in and aid in rebuilding the infrastructure don't want to take the risk, you know, whether they're American businesses or European businesses. So on some level, it's forcing Iraqi businesses to deal with it, which is good, I imagine. But, you know, it also is a sign of a complete failure on behalf of the free market utopia model that they were going into. And now we're getting reports from this piece by Patrick Coburn in The Independent that came out on the 17th of April, that they're not the troops themselves. The reason why information isn't coming out is that troops are not reporting, you know, any sort of insurgent activities unless there are fatalities, which means now you have a press that's bunkered in a few hotels out of fear of being kidnapped for money by any number of enterprising crooks, is that you have the troops that are coming back out of the field are not reporting to the military spokespeople are not reporting insurgent activity unless someone dies. So we have no real way of knowing what's really going on there.
Well, what's happening now is the journalists are starting to realize that in many instances, the good people, the people that are trying to do right by the people of Iraq, like this young lady that was killed by a suicide bomber the other day from California, that the good are dying along with whoever else happens to be in the way. If a suicide bomber shows up next to your car, it's not going to do any good that you are out trying to chronicle the number of Iraqi dead. You end up getting blown up with everybody else. And journalists are starting to realize that they, you know, no matter how fair they try to be, they still run the risk of being blown up, of being kidnapped and held for ransom. Again, not necessarily by anybody with a political objective, but somebody wants some money, or if that doesn't work, they turn it over to, they turn that person over to somebody that has a political objective, and then people get executed.
And there's also a couple of other implications, is that these journalists don't necessarily feel protected by the American troops. They don't feel safe out there. A lot of journalists have gotten shot for one reason or another, either accidentally or not, depending on, you know, how you think about that. And I think the other frightening thing is that a lot of troops are coming home, as you said, and a lot of these, you know, military, there's no indication that the insurgency has gotten any less.
No.
There's
none at all.
No indication that the insurgency is not, you know, continually preparing for more attacks. What is happening is the American troops have stopped engaging them as they slowly pull out, which, you know, depending on how you look at this, I mean, there could be close to, you know, 100,000 or more Iraqi civilians killed. The free market utopia model is breaking down. You know, infrastructure is broken down and rebuilding is not there. It seems to me that the neocon death cult is making a slow pulling out and just saying, look, you know, the government's there, you know, to hell with it. We're done. This is a failed experiment. Good luck. And in a few years, we'll have another Afghanistan, another Iran. You know, I don't know really what's going to happen, but it's so under the radar now. It's disturbing, and the implications are that most Americans, all they care about is getting the American troops home. They no longer care that we went there based on a lie. They no longer care that, you know, on some levels it's a tremendous failure. All the press around this new government has just sort of placated people. Now they're going, well, let's just come home and that's it. And that is going to be the dark stain on the conscience of this country when Iraq unfolds into something disastrous in a few years.
Well, Patrick Coburn reports in The Independent that 9 days after the presidential election here on November 11th, the police apparently collaborated with terrorists in abandoning 30 police stations without a fight in Mosul, and insurgents got $40 million worth of arms and equipment out of those raids.
Mm-hmm.
Now, think about that for a minute. People wonder how they're getting all this armament if there's supposed to be some level of security, 152,000 troops. The fact of the matter is it never has been secure. It's not secure now. These people are still getting access to arms and money, and as long as they get access to both, they will continue this fight against whoever's there.
And a good many Americans are not informed about this, nor do they care. They don't care that this president sent us there based on a lie. They don't care that much of this event was a failure. But, you know, oddly, you know, I'm thinking some of them are starting to care, you know, Riley, because, you know, Bush's approval rating at 44%, according to a recent Harris poll. There's some flack out of Texas against Tom DeLay from Republicans. You know, maybe there is a slight turning in the tide in terms of feeling taken advantage of, in terms of feeling, you know, pimp-slapped by this administration during the election, terrified, frightened into making a decision that was just based on fear. Hopefully things are changing, Riley.
I don't know. It doesn't seem to me that things are changing. It seems to me, at least as far as Iraq's concerned, that out of sight is out of mind. And to some extent for the American people, but more importantly, for the Bush administration. They don't have to deal with it as long as it's not in the public consciousness. So these deaths continue day after day, week after week, and he can paint a rosy picture of what's going on there because people aren't digging deep enough.
And also, in terms of deaths, when we come back from our break, we're going to talk about the toll that that AIDS has taken on the gay community in this country, not even speaking of the worldwide toll. But I want to read a little bit of from Larry Kramer's new book, The Tragedy of Today's Gays, before we interview him in the next hour, because I really think that it applies to everyone with progressive goals, with progressive values. So we'll do that when we come back. It's 45 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Hello, this is Mick Foley, professional wrestler and best-selling author, and you're listening to the two guys who give the right wing the smackdown. It's Mark Maron and Mark Riley with Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
800-801-GAME. That's 1-800-801-GAME. Call now. 1-800-801-GAME.
Past the hour. Let's go to the vegetarian Indian buffet.
Yeah.
After this. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey, there's peace in India and Pakistan.
That's what I hear, and they're going to stick to it.
Yeah.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Oh, there's the sound of the fax machine with the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Here's your liberal agenda for today, people. One, urge the College of Cardinals to reform the Pope's selection process. Black smoke equals dangerous carcinogens. Yes. Two, protest title of Broadway musical Spamalot. Canned meat is still murder, people. Still murder. Three, it's spring allergy season. Protest antihistamine medication. Pollen genocide is still genocide, people. Yes. Four, support anti-piracy bill for protecting the rights of artists. Then burn a copy of your friend's Hotel Rwanda DVD, but just to help spread the word. What is that to happen? Five, today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. You know why Lance Armstrong is retiring, don't you? The oil companies are pushing him out, man. Too many bikes are bad for business. Wake up, sheeple. They want to keep you in chains.
Uh-oh.
Did I mention I'll be in Cincinnati, Ohio at May 6th and 7th at Go Bananas? If you're listening to 1530 WCKY, the revolution of talk radio, or you're in the area, you got friends coming in, come on out. See me. It'll be fun. It'll be funny. I'm known to be funny when I do the stand-up. Just ask those people that out there in McIntosh, Florida, out on the old Zen retreat where I performed under a tent for 90 people with alligators just feet away from me. All right? Alligators and fanatical right-wing Republicans just feet away. I'm surrounded by alligators, and then just me and this small enclave, Oregon, and his wife Dorothy and 90 of their friends under a tent out there in the wilderness, surrounded. Still funny. That's my point. Still funny.
Even the gators laugh.
Yes, the gators were dying. They were. I felt bad for eating one of them the night before. Anyways, what are we doing? I'm talking about. You know, I had a conversation with Larry Kramer last week, and I sought Larry Kramer out myself, because books come through our office. You know, people want us to bring their writers on, and this book came through. It's got a very flashy cover, The Tragedy of Today's Gays. Some nice artwork. It's got a painting, a sort of almost like a silkscreen of Larry Kramer in front of an American flag. This is a transcript, basically, with an introduction and an afterword by Naomi Wolf, an introduction by Larry Kramer. But this was given at New York's Cooper Union on November 7th, 2004, 5 days following the reelection of George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it was presented by the HIV Forum in conjunction with the New York University's Office of Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Studies. But it's primarily the text of that speech and his intro. And I was reading this thing, and it moved me because it didn't just speak to gay people. I think it speaks to all progressives when he writes, "To us, it defies rational analysis that Bush, this incompetent, dishonest man, and his party should be reelected, or does it? I hope we all realize that as of November 2nd, 2004, gay rights in our country are officially dead, and that from here on, we are going to be led even closer to the guillotine. This past week, almost 60 million of our so-called fellow Americans voted against us. Indeed, 23% of self-identified gay people voted against us, too. That one I can't figure. The absoluteness of what has happened is terrifying. On the gay marriage initiatives alone, 2.6 million against us in Michigan, 3.2 million in Ohio, 1.1 million in Oklahoma, 2.2 million in Georgia, 1.2 million in Kentucky. George Bush won his presidency of our country by selling our futures. Almost 60 million people whom we live and work with every day think we are immoral. Quote unquote, moral values was at the top of many lists of why people supported George W. Bush. Not Iraq, not the economy, not terrorism. Moral values. In case you need a translation, that means us. It is hard to stand up to so much hate, which of course is just the way they want it. Please know that a huge portion of the population of the United States hates us. I don't mean dislike, I mean hate. You may not choose to call it hate, but I do. Not only because they refuse us certain marital rights, but because they have also elected a Congress that is overflowing with men and women who refuse us just about every other right to exist as well. Moral values, quote unquote, is really a misnomer. It means just the reverse. It means they don't think we are immoral and that we're dangerous and contaminated and dirty. How do you like being called immoral by some 60 million people? How do you like being thought of as dirty? This is not just anti-gay. This is what Doug Ireland, the fearless gay journalist, calls homo hate on the grandest scale. How do we stand up to 60 million people who have found a voice and a president who declares he has a mandate to do their bidding and not ours? The new Supreme Court, due any moment now, will erase us from the slate of everything possible in no time at all. Gay marriage, forget it. Gay anything good, forget it. Civil rights for gays, equal protection for gays, adoption rights. The only thing we are going to get from now on is years of increasing and escalating hate. Surely you must know this. Laws and regulations that now protect us will be repealed and rewritten. Please know all this. With the arrival of this second term of these hateful people, we come even closer to our extinction. We should have seen it coming. We are all smart people. How could we not have been prepared? That's from Larry Kramer's book, The Tragedy of Today's Gays, which you can get at morningsedition.com. We're going to have an interview with him. And we wrote Mayor Koch a letter because Larry Kramer also says in his book that of all the people in the world I condemn, Koch is the person most responsible for allowing HIV to grow unimpeded from 41 cases to more than 70 million. Now being tallied. It was on his watch it all began. He could have sounded the first and most important alarm to the city, to the president, to the media, to the world, in any and every way. He did not do so. When we come back in a minute, we will have my interview with Larry Kramer, and also we will have Ed Koch's response.
Yeah, that is a very, very serious charge. It's a half step away from calling Ed Koch a murderer.
Yes, and you know, ironically, or not. Apparently, Larry Kramer and Ed Koch live in the same building complex.
Yeah.
And we have Ed Koch's response to Larry Kramer, and we have Larry Kramer's interview. We'll be doing that when we come back, along with the Dream Diary and some of the other regular things you've grown to enjoy here on Morning's Edition.
This is Air America Radio.
Good morning. It's Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
We are here doing the show for you, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, condescending, liberal, selfish people, and also you Republicans out there who are selfish, but that's part of your ideology. I just want to open up the umbrella and keep us all in the tent. Anyways, here we go. My therapist always has me write down my dreams. Here's the one from last night. So I'm waiting online at the ATM listening to my iPod, Elvis Costello. Suddenly I hear a familiar voice. Mark, it's the iPod. Damn, why are you taking out money, Mark? I say, what do you mean? I need cash. No, you don't. Just put everything on your credit card. You'll get free airline miles. It's so convenient. Tune out. I say, shut up. The interest rates kill you. I don't want to get buried in debt. Mark, debt is good. It means that you've made a commitment to the economy. Cash is for strippers and bums. I say, and me, okay? I don't want to have to pay for today's lunch for the next 3 years. iPod says, girls love the platinum card, Mark. You have unlimited buying potential and unlimited ladies potential. And you can use all the help you can in the not-getting-younger department. I say, look, I'm getting cash, a-hole. Shut up. You know what else you can do with a credit card, Mark? Chop up Coke. Coke. Try doing that with your limp $5 bill. It's my turn at the machine. I put my ATM card in. I said, give me 200 in cash right now. Screw you, iPod. Mark, don't make me do this. I take the wad of 20s and laugh at him. Eat this. Mark, I'm sorry I have to do this. I cry out, stop it! Stop that! I'm grabbing at the earphones, but I can't pull them up. Stop! No! No more Barry Manilow! Buy something with your credit card and this will stop. And so I duck into the first open shop. It's Lane Bryant. And I buy some purple size 16 lady stretch pants. No more Barry Manilow. Good, Mark. But next time, put those on layaway. I woke up and my bed was filled with coffee cake crumbles.
Ooh.
Wow. So before we went away to the break, you know, I read what Larry Kramer said about Ed Koch, basically holding Ed Koch, mayor of New York at the time that the AIDS outbreak began, personally responsible for what is now up to 70 million people infected with the disease. And Ed Koch wrote back.
Yes, Ed Koch wrote back. And this was his response. And we're quoting Ed Koch. Larry Kramer's comments alleging that I am personally responsible, quote, for allowing HIV to grow unimpeded from 41 cases to the more than 70 million now being tallied, and that it was on my watch it all began, are patently false and ridiculous. I am proud of what I did as mayor of New York City to alert the public to the dangers of AIDS, to fund research into the plague, to treat and support its victims, and to warn the city's gay population to use condoms while engaging in sex. Regrettably, even today, knowing of the enormous dangers inherent in unprotected sex, many gay men intentionally do not use readily available condoms. That is the reason for the spread of AIDS, not the actions of public officials and medical researchers 20 years ago. It is pathetic to see that Kramer also attempts to attack me by alluding to my alleged sexuality. I do not discuss my private life with the press. At age 80, I consider any reference to my sex life to be complimentary. All the best, Ed Koch.
That was he written to the show. We requested the information from him. You know, Larry Kramer, it's just like Koch, to be cute at the end and in the context of the piece, blame the victim. Now here is my interview at his home last week with Larry Kramer.
I got The Tragedy of Today's Gays in the mail just out of nowhere. It was an envelope that came to our station. No one recommended it to me, but I have read your stuff before. I find you very compelling, and you're one of the few people with the courage to speak up about anything. And when I read the book, it spoke to me, and I am not particularly gay. I'm sure there are parts of me that might be. But I am not a gay person, but as a person from the left, as a liberal, I found that you addressed a type of apathy, a type of fear, and a type of inability to speak out that is really important for the entire left to reckon with. And what I want to talk about initially is you basically say to the gay community primarily, this is a transcript of a speech, that there are 60 million people out there that hate you.
Right. Easily 60 million. And those are the people who voted against the marriage initiatives in all of the states in which it was on the ballot. So I'm sure there are a lot more because a lot of the states didn't have it on their ballot.
What do you attribute the apathy to now? I mean, this is the generation after you in the gay community who are not using condoms. The numbers are going back up again. There's a rapid drug use. Why are they giving up?
I think to be gay for a young kid in this country right now must be awful. And I think the drug use, the crystal meth, people don't realize that crystal meth is essentially an antidepressant, like whatever they call Xanax.
It keeps you up for 4 days.
But it's unfortunately a little more addictive.
Yeah.
But basically, it's an antidepressant, and there's an awful lot to be depressed about if you are gay today. All of these terrible people who are doing all these terrible things to us, we are inundated when we go on our websites with the horrible things that are happening to us everywhere. And it's getting worse and worse, and it's going to get even worse. These people are not in power just for now. These people are in power for a long time to come.
And you think that this was, you know, inherently part of this conservative trend, which was essentially in its birth to protect the free market, was anti-gay from the beginning?
Well, yes, I do. But I think the real hate is only surfacing in the last few years, where we've become more visible, where we've had certain rights the Supreme Court has given us, and where this marriage stuff has surfaced so boldly. You know, they don't hate you so actively when they can't see you. Now they can see us.
And
we,
also,
we
they
knew
can,
it would happen.
You did.
Yeah.
How so? I mean, in terms of when the original movement to seek an identity as a community happened, you knew that there was a backlash to it.
When you're in the closet, they can't throw a brick at you. But if they see you out in the street and they know you're gay, they can throw a brick at you.
But also, they've empowered religious fanatics to speak for them, and that has given them some
well, that's because there
confidence.
There hasn't been anyone in authority in the country saying don't do that. The recent presidents have all been elected because of these people, so they get the support of the White House.
Mm.
In the past, you wouldn't have had that kind of support from Dwight Eisenhower, say, or Harry Truman. Harry Truman didn't know what a homosexual was, but I'm serious.
So you blame Democrats as well as Republicans, liberals as well as conservatives for this type of negligence and this type of contempt?
Yes, I do. I don't think there's any separation anymore. I mean, 30% of gay people voted for George Bush. So our own people voted for him.
That must really sort of, upset you.
I must say this, though. I've been gay all my life. I didn't become an activist until 1981, when all this started, when I was in my 40s. And what I don't understand about the gay population would fill 100 books. I think I understand what it's like to be gay, but there's certain things I can't understand, and you're telling me it's the same in the democratic world as probably in all people. I do not understand why people don't fight to save their lives when their lives are threatened. Why so few gay people at the height of AIDS in the mid to late 80s were out there fighting with us, with ACT UP primarily. You know, you're going to die. Isn't that worth fighting for?
Yeah.
And the same thing is happening now. They are destroying us, the other side, this cabal of haters. You would think everybody would rise up and say, I'm not going to take it anymore. What can I do? What organization can I join? Everybody says, Larry, thank you for what you did. And I say, screw you. Why didn't you do it too? I'm not doing anything that anybody else can't do, you know. Or you don't have to do anything except write a letter, write a check, I don't know. Stand outside somebody's house with a sign.
Scream. Yeah. Well, I think that
you don't put your head in the sand.
Yes, I agree with you, and I think it's interesting in reading the piece that you're very specific in saying that these guys that hate us, that hate gay people, that hate liberals, that hate the left, Democrats, hate anybody that's different than them, have been diligently working for 35 years to create
and
a network.
Go to a meeting once a week, and it's called church.
Yeah. Okay.
People, and that's how they stay in touch with each other. That's how they fundraise. That's how they pass along their propaganda, how they build their hate. But they do it once a week, all year round. We don't do anything all year round except dance and sing.
There you go. That's the first part of my interview with Larry Kramer. The book is The Tragedy of Today's Gays. You can get it at morningsedition.com. It was a great talk we had, and we're going to continue it when we come back at 16 past the hour here on Air America Radio.
morningsedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your vlog. morningsedition.com. Air America Radio.
Details on the 90-day trial guarantee. Call 1-877-289-9200. That's 1-877-289-9200.
20 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Good morning, Seditions Air America radio program. We're going to continue now with a conversation I had with Larry Kramer at his home last week. We were talking about apathy. The book is The Tragedy of Today's Gays. You can get that at morningsedition.com. But it's also The Tragedy of Today's Left and Progressives in terms of, I thought, what we were talking about. Here we go.
It's odd to me that there can't, you know, I guess it's just their own personal fear of being stigmatized or that they don't want to play sexual politics.
What we don't do, this is something that I've come to realize fairly recently, and it's pretty basic. They don't self-identify as gays first. I'm a gay man. I'm a gay man before I'm a Jewish man. I'm a gay man before I'm a white man. I'm a gay man before I'm a writer, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That is my being, the essence of my being. A black person says I'm a black person,
mm-hmm.
First and foremost. He has no choice. Gay people don't do that. And because we don't say it first and foremost, that's equivalent to being in the closet.
The book is The Tragedy of Today's Gays. It's a very compelling book. I had my wife read it. I read it.
What did she say?
She's blown away by it. You know, I underlined it. It made me go read the Powell Manifesto. It made me do more research.
So great from a straight reader. Thank you.
Well, I'll tell you, as I said before at the beginning, that I think this speaks to the issue of, because to me, you know, your passion and your anger represents what, you know, what the left used to be, whether it's gay or straight. I mean, there was a time where people felt that they were fighting for their lives on a day-to-day basis, that there were groups of people that were not represented in society that needed to be represented, and somebody had to step up and speak for them. Now, because of money and because of, you know, salon issues and different things, you know, the left is sort of broken apart. So in my head, I read it as a person who's saying, well, this guy, Larry Kramer is bringing, you know, the type of anger and appeal that used to happen on the left all the time.
These kids, they must have been subliminally so stunted by what went before them with HIV/AIDS and also with the hatefulness of the other side. And I just think it's paralyzed. It's paralyzed an entire population in a very terrifying way.
I believe that's a good word.
Yeah.
I think that there's a sort of a shock or a paralysis, you know, because some people say apathetic, and I think that is a type of exhaustion that comes from fear.
Mm-hmm. Paralyzed.
I think that's a good thing, because I think apathy is a strange word. I think people,
I don't see them. You know, I know they're there. I live in Venice Village. I swear to God, I do not see them on the streets anymore. I don't see us anywhere. I don't see groups of us. I don't see gay bars. I don't see gay coffee houses.
Do you see any hope, Larry? Larry
well,
Kramer.
That's what the book is. It's really, the book is my finally having to face up to the fact that no, I do not see any hope. I do not see us getting anywhere as a people, as a community. And I've never really faced that. I've been making the speech, as I say, since 1981, and I have not seen any progress. I've seen most of us die, a lot of us die, but I do not see us getting anywhere where we should be. And I didn't know that when I sat down to write the speech. I didn't want to write the speech, but then I was implored to write it and gave in, and I'm glad I did. But in the writing of the speech, especially in the writing of the introduction, which came after the speech and is in this book, I had to say to myself, Larry, do you realize what you're saying? This is hopeless.
Well, you know, I just think that, you know, in terms of, you know, people, you know, who are gay, who aren't gay, to read the passion of somebody who is angry and doesn't want to take it and is rational, you can get definitely a sort of activist buzz from reading The Tragedy of Today's Gays.
Or a sadness about the state of life. $10.
Yeah. But the sadness, you know, I'll tell you, though, it's like you said in the book, you know, there is, you know, you do put down in this book and say, well, I'm going to do a little research, I want to learn more about this, and I want to do something. You know, how long that lasts is really up to you. You know, because you also address that in the book. But some people, they're like, you said it about the speech, that some people are going to leave the room and go, I'm going to do something. And then 3 days later, they're like, what am I going to do?
If you're going to be an activist, you have to do it every single day of your life. And that scares most people. The right wing knows how to be an activist every day of its life because they got God on their side. So they're doing it for God. God is their co-pilot, whatever. And so that gives them a certain sustaining power to do this every day, and we don't have that. But you have to be an activist every day. You cannot stop being an activist. You have to always fight every time something comes hurled at you, and that happens all the time. So there's no way to stop. I mean, I'm almost 70 years old, June 25th, and here I am on your, you know, radio.
Still doing it. Still fighting.
It becomes second nature after a while.
Well, I hope that those are great words to end on, and those are inspirational words. Thank you, Larry Kramer, for spending this time with me.
Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you.
That was Larry Kramer. His book is The Tragedy of Today's Gays. It's a very empowering read. It's a frustrating but invigorating read, because, you know, it really puts you on the spot. It's one of those screeds that you read and you're like, I got to do something.
Well, yeah, he doesn't take any shorts, Larry Kramer. He's been an activist, and you heard him say, you can never stop fighting. That's something that perhaps our friends in the Democratic Party might want to take to heart. You never stop fighting. You never concede. You never say, oh, my God, they control the Congress. Yeah, okay. So
we gotta
you
got to pick our fights.
No. You go and you develop a strategy to take it back.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, he's right. The people that are running this country hate gays. I mean, if you look at their policy positions, if you look at the legislation they're prepared to introduce, they hate gays. Gays.
A lot of them hate us.
Yes.
I got, you know, coming up, we got your confessions, 866-303-2270. I have a confession to make in relation to my chat with Larry Kramer, actually.
Yeah.
So we will be back with your confessions and mine after this on Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Magazine's Hal Epson on the environmental backlash. Remember, you've got Al today, tomorrow, always on Frank and...
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
That sounds like Dolomite to me.
It does, doesn't it? It's the same kind of ear.
That's
Electric Mud. That's that weird fusion blues album that Chess's kid made, you know, with Muddy Waters during the psychedelic era. They're like, maybe we should bring Muddy in with some of these session guys and just do some groovy blues.
Yeah, sometimes it works, sometimes it don't.
Well, some people love this record. Some people think it's like a
groundbreaking. Yeah, it was visionary. Absolutely.
You know, it's not easy. It's not always easy being a liberal. We all stray from the straight and narrow from time to time, but when we need to unburden ourselves, we can always confess our liberal sins. If you want to take a turn in the liberal confessional, give us a call at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. But right now it's my turn. Bless me, Brother Riley, for I've sinned.
How can I ease your burden, my son?
Well, I'm feeling a lot of anxiety about my interview with Larry Kramer.
Because he was so erudite and such a passionate spokesman for his cause?
No, because he's
gay. He's gay, Mark.
Not so loud. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I get it. He's gay. He likes men. It's just that, you know, I'm worried about the way that I'm worried about it. I'm worried about the way I came off.
That really makes no sense. What are you saying?
Well, I think I came off as a little gay initially in our interview, and then I think like Kramer thought I was gay. So then for the rest of the interview, I went out of my way to let him and the listeners know that I'm not gay. Like when I mentioned my wife, like totally out of the blue, and you know, and when I said I'm not gay, does that make me a little homophobic? Am I wrong?
Did his thinking you were gay make you uncomfortable?
Well, not at first. I mean, at first I think it kind of helped the interview. You know, there was some real chemistry there. But then I got uncomfortable, and I feel bad about it.
So maybe your problem isn't that you're a homophobe. Your problem is that you're a bit of a gay teaser, Mark. You flirt with certain men, and that's going to happen.
What? Did it sound like I was flirting with Larry Kramer?
I don't know. Were you flirting with Larry Kramer?
I don't know, man. I don't know.
All right. Settle down.
All right. Sorry.
I'm not sure you've committed much of a crime here, but I think I have a good idea for your penance.
Okay, hit me, Brother Riley.
I want you to call Larry Kramer and ask him out, like to a ball game or to a concert, anything. And I want you to go and just hang out. Just two guys, just hanging out. But don't fawn over him so much this time.
Oh, my God, I fawned over him?
Just a little bit. Now go forth and sin no more.
Amen. Oh, wow. Okay, that's so confusing.
You all tease right, you.
That's so good. Thanks, Brother Riley. Now, if anyone else wants to confess and seek absolution in our liberal confessional, you can give us a call right now at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. Bernadine in Cincinnati, what's your confession? What is your sin?
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
Me, Mark, and Mark, for I have sinned.
Yes.
Terrible.
What?
William Crystal gave a talk at Earlham College, and it's a Quaker college.
Uh-huh.
And about 3 minutes into the talk, a student came up and threw a pie in his face. Oh, that's what I did. I laughed for a week. It was horrible. I just feel so terrible because I'm still laughing. I feel so happy. And I feel terrible because I feel so happy that William Crystal got a pie in the face for saying all of his, you know, what.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I don't think you sinned. I think that
it's terrible not to be like them. We cannot be like them.
Hey, don't beat yourself up. Don't beat yourself up. I got. What do you think, man?
I maybe I'm taking this wrong, but I mean it's
don't
a pie.
Make me read the weekly sin.
Exactly.
Do not
that's
make me read the
no, it's a pie. It's not a fist. I think that you need to be the next pie thrower.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
no,
one that you bake yourself. How about that?
No, I can't do that. We can't be like them.
We're not being like them. They don't throw pies. I've never known them to throw a pie.
You ever heard of a Republican throwing a pie?
What they do is lie and propagandize and kill people. I've never heard about them throwing a pie. I think the pie is absolutely the tool of the prankster left.
Yeah.
It's certainly not being like them. But you seem to kind of have a secret craving to
read. It's violence. It's violence.
It's a pie.
It's a pie. He'll lick it off his face.
No, I'm a true liberal. I'm a true progressive. We cannot do that.
All right, I'll tell you what.
You can't throw pies.
If you're a true liberal, let it cool before you throw it.
All right, here's what you do then. If you're a true liberal and this pie thing, you know, offends you, at the next Republican speaking engagement of any kind or any operative of the right, why don't you just go to it and hiss?
Yeah. Or bake a pie and give it out to people if you don't want to.
And
throw
then shoot some sort of condescending glares and nod your head back and forth.
I won't even get in. They won't let me in.
Yes, they will.
They know you, Brandy.
Because I have to tell the truth because I'm a real liberal.
Oh.
They'll ask me if I hate W and I'll say yes.
No, they don't. They're not.
They don't ask,
you
that. They don't make you sign that kind of loyalty oath, do they?
Okay, then I'll tell you what. Then stand out the door and when whoever it is comes out, go, you're bad.
There you go.
Is that too much? Is that bad, too? We can't do that either?
I can do that.
You can do that. Okay.
Yeah, I can do that.
Bernadine, just remember, it's a pie.
Yeah.
Okay, bye-bye.
Yeah, bye. Thanks for calling. Man, you know,
it's
this whole
pie.
We can't be like they are thing is really, it's deep.
That's a little ridiculous. I mean, she sounds like a very nice person, but, I mean, even the left say a pie's not enough. I mean, you know what I mean? I mean, that's an old prankster gig. That's an old, that's a silly thing.
Well, they want a pie with a nail file in it, some of them.
They
want to do damage. Pies are just embarrassing. They don't really hurt.
Yeah, I mean, they hit David Horowitz with one, and he called it, this is horrible.
This is Horowitz.
These are liberal fascists. It's like, it's a pie.
Right.
You look like a fool. You deserve to look like a fool. Get the pie off your face. And after that, try to, you know, come on.
Hey,
I'm sorry.
Hey.
I'm sorry. Bernadine, I understand what you're saying, but please, it's a pie.
It's only a pie.
It's a pie. Okay, here we go. Krista in Tennessee, how are you? What's your sin? What's your sin?
Well, I'm driving to school right now. I'm a teacher. I teach special ed. Some of my kids are anger management kids, and I try really hard to be patient with them and teach them to treat other people the right way.
Yes.
Okay, well, we have a storeroom that we have for the fifth grade on, like, right across the hall from me, and it has a life-size cardboard cutout of President Bush, and I flip it off. I give it to Bird every single time I go into that storeroom. Not in front of the kids, but I just...
Not in front of the kids.
Well, you know, this sounds... and you feel bad about this?
Well, because, you know, I'm trying to teach them how to behave and that I... You know, you should respect people and treat people with kindness, and then here I am, you know, right behind their backs. I go and flip him off all the time.
Well, give yourself a break, will you?
Yeah.
Chris, I mean, first
don't
of
beat
all,
yourself up, huh?
Maybe you should throw a pie at the cutout. But what I want you to do is, first of all, it's, you can be respectful, but the reason that those cardboard cutouts exist is because they're not really the guy, and you can use it in the way that you're using it. And I think that your penance is really to, I want that thing to be like the portrait of Dorian Gray. Don't just flip it off, but each day maybe, you know, draw something on the face, maybe a little Hitler mustache, and, you know, start to deface it even more, and then call and confess that when the principal finds out that someone's doing that, you don't cop to it. Then call and confess that.
Yeah.
How's that?
Then you will have really done something bad.
Thanks for calling, Krista.
Thanks.
You.
You're nicer than I am. I was going to have her, you know, have the anger management kids tackle a dummy.
Tackle. These people are, it's very nice. They're very,
I know.
They're very nice, but she's really guilty. But there's no hypocrisy.
What happened
in that
to the days when we used to get confessions? I carry a gun. I mean, what's going on here?
Exactly. People going to feel bad yelling at the TV set. I think I hurt the man on television's feelings. But that's very, it's adorable in a way, and I don't mean to, you know, be condescending. But it's a pie.
Yeah,
it's
really
a cardboard cutout. Let's take another one here. Okay, Rory, what's your sin, Rory, in Manhattan?
Hi. Well, this kind of relates to the pie and is partly a dream. And, well, I have kind of sexual fantasies about and culture, and I'm gay.
Wait a minute. Did you see the Time magazine cover?
Yeah, that's it. That must have been it. I was looking at it last night, the shoes and everything.
She doesn't like it.
I would like sort of a dominatrix fantasy, and then I would get the upper hand, and then I would grab her by the hair and drag her around my railroad flat.
Well, so you're gay, and you have sexual fantasies about Ann Coulter dominating you. But the weird thing is that when you grab her by the hair, it'll probably come off and reveal the man that she is.
Then, hey, I was thinking more like a Barbie doll, you know, that drag around until her stomach gets dirty.
Okay.
that kind of thing.
Well, as a gay man who is now, you know, confessing that you have this sexual fantasy with Ann Coulter that you feel guilty about, I think the only penance is you're going to have to, you know, actively sexually fantasize about her for 2 weeks.
Ooh.
Okay, I'll start right now. Have a good one, guys.
We gotta go. Take care.
Yeah, we don't want to hear that part.
Let's take one more. Oh, boy. Greg, how are you? What's your sin?
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good,
all right,
man.
I'm a huge fan of the show from the beginning.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you.
I feel real dirty, and I heard you guys talking about that you needed a good one, and I got one. I went to my bachelor party a few months ago, and I got taken to the NRA shooting range.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not a gun person. I never held a gun in my life, but I liked it. I never wanted to really own a gun, but I had a fun time with it, and I've secretly felt dirty about it the whole time.
Okay, well, you know, that's a sin I can relate to, because I grew up, you know, in New Mexico, and I shot a couple of guns myself, and you know what? It does feel good. So I'm going to have to figure out what a penance is, and we'll get back to you after the break. It's 44 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio.
Join the Morning Sedition. Right now, call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
You qualify to dramatically reduce your tax debt. Call 800-661-0491 right now. That's 800-661-0491. Call right now.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. We're finishing up our liberal confessional segment. We got Greg on the line in New Jersey, who was taken by some friends on his bachelor party to a NRA shooting range.
Heal me, please.
And
heal
was,
me. I need to heal life.
Was so sad that he enjoyed shooting a gun. I think that if you shoot a gun at a shooting range, I don't know how horrible you have to feel, unless you're actually feeling like perhaps maybe you wanted to put a little ideology behind that shooting. And I think we can kill two birds in one stone here. Is the next time you go to the shooting range, we're going to talk to Krista, who has that cardboard cutout of George Bush, and we're going to have you take it to the shooting range and shamelessly ask them to set it up at the end of your range.
There you go.
Sweet.
All right. So if you have the courage to do that, I think that'll absolve you of your sins, Greg.
I feel the healing.
Okay,
thank
buddy.
You
take it easy.
All right, man.
Sometimes I don't know if we're doing this in the right direction.
Sure.
All right. So let's talk more about this. I went to the Family Research Council website.
Oh, yeah. FRC.
Tony Perkins. And I went there because they're doing this big thing. Justice Sunday. This is the neocon death cult's crystal fascist zombie brigade. One of the big ones is the Family Research Council, along with a focus on family. And I'll tell you something. You go to the Air America website, Riley, you can't even download our beautiful, funny comedy bits so you can send them to your friends. You go to the Focus on Family or the Family Research Council website. Look at this. I downloaded this flyer. It said that you could do this flyer for Justice Sunday, which has got this doofy-looking teenage kid, you know, holding a gavel in one hand and a Bible in the other, and he looks like he's just about to, you know, start hitting himself on the head with one of them.
Yeah,
what a ridiculous thing! It's like, what's it gonna be? Justice? A hammer or a book? But what I'm saying is very effective. They're very effective at networking. They're very effective at getting information out. And this thing is supposed to have. All right, look, I went to the website, as I said. Tony Perkins is going to speak. James Dobson, founder and chairman of Focus on Family. Al Mohler, is that how you pronounce his name?
Yeah.
President of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Chuck Colson, criminal.
Oh, yeah.
Famous Watergate
convicted
criminal.
Convicted criminal.
But Bill Frist, not listed. Not listed.
Not listed?
As a guest.
Did I say he was going to take his... Oh, no, he hasn't taken his name off.
I don't know if he's taken his name off, but as you know, Senator Bill Frist, in an attempt to kiss up to these extremists, these radicals, these anti-American, anti-constitutional, Christian fanatics who want to usurp the judiciary branch of government so it serves their own needs with their own type of activist judges. These are people that see this as an opportunity to finally... barrel through and take hold of the judiciary so that this becomes a land ruled by biblical law, which is against the Constitution, against everything this country stands for. That makes them traitors, anti-American, anti-constitutional traitors. Tony Perkins, James Dobson, Al Mohler, Chuck Colson, who I don't think has much to say.
Chuck Colson is a born again Christian. He got born again not long after he got out of stir.
Yeah,
and he's become one of these. And see, this is the thing people need to realize about the Dobsons, the Perkins, and all the rest of these guys have become media spokespeople, but more importantly, I think sort of like media icons for this evangelical religious movement. These are the point people. These are the folks that they pushed out front. And now, you go back 20 years and ask yourself if the Senate Majority Leader would have showed up to such a gathering. People would say, what, are you crazy? But things have changed. A lot of stuff that we thought had been buried once and for all, maybe by the end of the 1970s, coming right back.
Well, what Larry Kramer was talking about in our interview, and you can get in his book, The Tragedy of Today's Gays, is he turned me on to some research about this, about the beginning of the momentum of the free market conservatives. Once Barry Goldwater lost, in the early 70s, they did everything. They put billions and millions and millions of dollars into creating an operation, a network, think tanks, to change the cultural language to support the free market economy and the free global free market capitalism so that it would never be taken to task again by what they saw as socialists or liberals or communists. And alongside of them, the Reconstructivist Christians also started happening. And these have counter-evolved, and not counter-evolved, but involved in simpatico for years, and now you're seeing this weird, unholy union of renegade extremists, these Christian fanatic radicals with this, conservative neocon movement. And this is very frightening stuff to me. So what he's trying to do, what Bill Frist is trying to do, is kind of bridge that gap in preparation for his, 2008 presidential run. And he's getting a lot of flack for it because Bill Frist is a physician. He's supposed to be, a person who respects the Hippocratic Oath. He's also considers himself a true conservative, yet now he has to also present himself as an extremist religious fanatic who is anti-American to these people that want him to. And even some Bible Belt Republicans apparently are troubled by Frist's involvement in the event. And I think that goes to say a lot.
Well, what they're, of course, looking at in the end is making war on the American judiciary. Now, there's been talk among some of these folks and their fellow travelers that the Supreme Court doesn't need to be nine people. It could probably just be one. There's talk among these folks of literally redrawing the federal judiciary maps so that there, first of all, will be no more Ninth Circuit, which they consider totally liberal and totally out of sync with their agenda. But what you have here, Mark, is a consistent voting bloc. That's what draws the Bill Frists and the Brownbacks and the Cornyns and the rest of these guys. They see a consistent and loyal voting bloc that will come out not just for them, but for candidates they endorse and other people who think like them. And they really believe that they can remake the country based on the judicious use of that voting bloc. These folks come out to vote, and they come out to vote whether it's for the president of the United States or whether it's for their local school
board. Well, look, not without a fight, my friend. 60 million, you know, 60 million is not a mandate when 56 million voted against these people. And the truth of the matter is, that's just the reality of it. They can't remake this country without a fight from us, hopefully, you know, starting from the Democrats. And these people are trying to implant their own activist judges. There's no morality here. All these idiots, Tony Perkins, James Dobson, they're jockeying for power, and they, along with the Republican Party, are exploiting the stupid and exploiting the frightened to have a desire to repress people's civil rights.
Well, unfortunately for a lot of the people in this movement, when these guys get to a certain level and then get ambitious, and I'm talking about, for example, Ralph Reed, now you're starting to see people cross that line from simple evangelical proselytizing into politics. Reed is going to run for lieutenant governor of Georgia, or at least he's considering that run. And what you're seeing is even people on the religious right now saying, well, gee, is he getting a little ambitious? Is he trying to reach too far?
They're hypocrites, and you'll see the hypocrisy when we prove to you when we come back that Supreme Court Justice Scalia is an activist judge.
All that and Jeff Daniels when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Morning, geniuses. It's 6 past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yes, it is.
Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio for the philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor who think that we are servicing some sort of broader political agenda. You know, we have our show here. We talk from our point of view, from our angle, from our side of the fence here. But we can't please everybody, but we are here for you in the best way possible. Isn't that right, Mark Riley?
Well, we try.
Sure.
Yeah.
And there you go, Kalo with the cup of noodles. Kalo the Costco ho with the Costco cup of noodles going, having the early morning cup of noodles fix. My cats are getting so damn big, you guys. It's ridiculous. They're now knocking over tables.
Uh-oh.
I have three monster cats now. Unbelievable. And you know what? I'm a little pissed off. The guy who owned the frame store around the corner, the guy who had, he had a cat in the backyard that, not in the backyard, but behind where I got my kittens, there was his cat, and there was the mother of my kittens, and there was a couple other cats living back there. The guy goes out of business, right? He's been out of business for a couple months. I just assume he took his cat with him.
No.
I ran into him on the street the other day. I'm like, did you take that cat? He's like, oh, I don't know what happened to the cat. What do you mean you know what happened to the cat? You don't take your cat with you? That's the thing. That's why there are so many feral cats, is because people are just like, what do I care? That's, you know what? And I don't want to blame the victim, but it might be partly because the cat's a little detached. You know? So people are figuring, hey, it didn't like me anyways. It doesn't need me. It'll be okay on its own. And then you get millions of them.
Well, I mean, the thing is, he's probably figuring the next store he opens, he's not going to need a cat to kill the rats. Because most of the time when people have business establishments and they have cats in them, it's to get rid of the rodent problem, at least in urban areas such as the one we're in.
You don't got to tell me. I got a cat that used to live with me, and now he's working out in Brooklyn for a deli owner.
For a union scale, right?
Yeah, for a union cat scale. That's like, you know, it's based on a quota of mouse caught or rat. One rat's equal to two mice, apparently.
Oh, is that what it is?
But I check up on the cat. Apparently.
Did Bush start this?
Yes.
I think he started this unionist movement.
No, I'm sure they did. We'll find out on Friday. But But, you know, I talked to Tony, the Yemeni guy across the street from me in the deli, and he tells me his brother, the cat whisperer, who was able to take the one, my meanest feral kitten, and apparently turn him into just a lovely deli cat, is doing fine. I will be in Cincinnati May 6th and 7th. If you'd like to come down, there's going to be four shows at Go Bananas. If you're listening to 1530 WCKY, the Revolution of Talk Radio, please come down. You can go to morningsedition.com for ticket info. Support the campaign to oust Tom DeLay. Go to ourfuture.org to contribute if you'd like to get involved in that. We're going to talk a little bit about DeLay in just a second, but let's talk a little bit about this. I think this is an interesting piece here. It's an editorial piece from the New York Times. It basically says that no matter what, you know, you can look at Justice Antonin Scalia as an activist judge for a very specific decision that he made. You know, and these, you know, this is the thing about, you know, all this, you know, Christo-fascist zombie brigade, anti-American, anti-constitutional momentum against overthrowing the judiciary of this country because of what they call liberal activist judges, is that most of the judges that Bush wanted in are in. Most of the judges, by and large, were appointed by conservatives. And these conservatives, some of these judges, are very activist, including Antonin Scalia.
Well, this goes back to a decision he made back in 1991. And this has to do with whether or not the citizens of a state can sue a state over some alleged or perceived wrongdoing. Okay, now here's what the 11th Amendment says about that. Okay, the 11th Amendment says, I'm quoting here directly, that federal courts cannot hear a lawsuit against a state brought by, quote, citizens of another state or by citizens or subjects of any foreign state. Now, you did not see citizens of that particular state. That's not in there.
This is the kind of thing I got to read nine times.
Yeah, but see, that part's not in there.
Yeah.
But in a 1991 decision, Justice Scalia said the following. Quote, despite the narrowness of its terms, the 11th Amendment has been understood by the courts, quote, to stand not so much for what it says, but for the presupposition of our constitutional structure, which it confirms.
Mm.
That is an activist interpretation of the United States Constitution. In other words, that whole thing about being a strict constructionist, you only read what's on the paper in the Constitution. He's not doing that.
No.
He's saying, I am interpreting the Constitution, I am interpreting the 11th Amendment to mean that something that it does not say, and that is that citizens of a state cannot bring a suit in the federal court against the state in which they live.
But I'll tell you something, judicial activism on either side, as long as it's not somebody in there saying, I interpret this biblical passage to mean that we can stone all homosexuals and hang adulterers. You know, that's the last thing I need.
Stop. Yeah.
And then also the classic example of conservative inconsistency, and this is from the editorial piece, was in the re-election, in the stolen election of 2000, the Bush versus Gore. Apparently, I'm quoting from the article, not only did the court's conservative bloc trample on the floor to state courts and stop the vote counting, it declared its ruling would not be a precedent for future cases. And how does Justice Scalia explain that decision? Apparently, in a recent New Yorker profile, he is quoted as saying with startling candor that, quote, the only issue was whether we should put an end to it after 3 weeks of looking like a fool in the eyes of the world, end quote. And that is not a constitutional argument. It's an unapologetic defense of judicial activism. This is from Adam Cohen's editorial observer piece in the New York Times today.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's I don't want to look like no fool defense. I mean, that's essentially what he's saying, that they stopped the vote count in Florida because they didn't want to look bad.
Yeah.
That's absurd.
And the interesting thing is about this this anti-American trend on behalf of the religious right and some of the politicians that align themselves with them, including Tom DeLay, is that they're hypocrites. And most of the judges, as I said, are conservatives, and some of the judges that ruled against what they wanted were conservatives. These people are renegades. They're extremists, and they should be treated as such. And until this administration, or until the people of the United States rise up against this type of stuff, they are fighting against the very basic fabric of what makes this country amazing. yeah. and what makes this country embracing to all different types of people who practice all different types of religions. These people have a fascist intent, and I'm not saying that lightly. I don't want to throw that word around, but they should be seen as such. And if you're a Christian and you're a progressive, you know, you should definitely, you know, talk to your clergymen. You know, talk to them, you know, ask them what you can do. How do you get involved? I mean, these people are saying a lot of horrible things and trying to enact a crystal fascist sort of government, a theocracy, in the name of what you believe, you know, Christ really meant.
Well, see, the one good thing that's coming out of all this is that Tom DeLay now really doesn't have time to focus his energy and attention on getting rid of judges he doesn't like anymore, because he's got to turn around and finally start dealing with these ethics allegations that are swirling around him. He sent out, Mark, a direct mailing to his district in Sugar Land, Texas, supposedly offering a point-by-point refutation of the charges against him. And most of them involve, well, somebody else did the same thing. Or nobody's found that I've broken the law.
Oh, that's the famous, you know, right-wing Clinton defense.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, can't these people stay on the page? Can't they just own up to what they did? You know, whether he broke the law or not, he's dirty. He's ethically compromised. He's a corrupt person that has used the Congress to as an opportunist would, not to represent people. He pays a lot of lip service to accommodating religious fanatics within his district who can now see plainly that with all this swirling, if Bob Dole is saying,
yeah,
he's
Bob Dole
come
says,
clean.
Yes, Bob Dole says he's got to come clean. And remember, we talked yesterday about the fact that DeLay had raised about $400,000+. Well, this is part of what it's for. This is the first shot in the conservative response to what they perceive as the attacks on Tom DeLay. So he sends something to his district that he hopes will firm up support inside his district. Then he'll start working on inside the Beltway. He'll start working on shoring up his support among those people who may have wavered. I mean, there's been Chris Shays and a few other people.
Santorum said he's got to come clean.
Gingrich has talked about him. Well, he's now his next step after this is to try and shore up that base inside the Beltway. Watch.
Yeah, I'm going to watch, you know, because I want to see this guy go down. And I think that what's happening is a lot of Republicans, even in Texas, are, you know, what do you want? Do you want an ethical, you know, House of Representatives, or do you want to support a guy just because you think it's your party's obligation? Mm-hmm. What do you want? What do you want from the United States government? Really? 15 past the hour, we'll be back with more about DeLay, or maybe more about new genetic strands in the air of New York.
Ooh. You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
That's cabinet refacing from Sears Home Services. 1-800-828-1200. That's 1-800-828-1200.
Twenty past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's the Morning Sedition program here on Air America Radio. We've got actor Jeff Daniels coming up. He sang some songs, and we talked a little bit about film, but oddly, very humble, nice guy.
Yeah. Yeah, really nice guy.
He's going to be playing here in New York tonight over at Birdland for a couple of shows. But we got a caller here, you know, since our president is openly operating in a different reality. We think it's important that Americans know what's happening in his alternate universe. Luckily, we have a staffer who lives in that world. So now on the phone once again is Planet Push Bureau Chief Lawton Smalls. Good morning, Lawton.
Good morning, Mark. God's got a drum full of ping pong balls, and he's pulling out a poker. There he is.
That was almost funny, Lawton. So the College of Cardinals is meeting to pick a new pope, as you said.
Well, you got that right. Mm-hmm. I don't mean to sound insensitive, Mark. But what with the Pope, you know, barely in the box and all, but
yeah.
We need us a new Pope.
Uh-huh.
Toot, sweet, promptissimo. Fill that chair.
Look, I thought John Paul was your friend, culture of life and whatnot.
Oh, yeah, but, you know, old Popey Pope fought President George W. Mandate two-term Bush just a little too often.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
He was against the liberation of Iraq.
Uh-huh.
He's uppity, if you ask me.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I represent billions of people or something like that. You know, I say, it doesn't matter who's wearing the big hat in Rome. In the United States of America, George W. Bush is the Pope.
Yeah.
End of story.
Yeah, all right. I understand. Yeah, I get it, Lawton. All right. Well, it looks like the College of Cardinals may pick an Italian to be the next Pope, or even an African.
I don't think we're going to see that.
Well, why? What are you neocon freaks cooking up now, Lawton?
All right.
All
right. Ready for it.
Okay.
The first Southern Baptist popes.
Oh, come on. Shut up. That's
Stop it. America contains every nationality, so picking a Southern Baptist is just like picking an African or a Venezuelan or an Italian. We got half those cardinals in our back pocket.
Oh,
anyway.
Come on.
The same fellas who fixed Ohio for us.
No.
Spread a few lira around, making some friends. You know what I'm saying. We took Italy in WW2, and we're taking it again in W2.
Oh, my God.
Italy, back pocket.
Great. Just what the world needs. So who's your candidate, Lawton?
Well, he'd have to be conservative.
Uh-huh.
He'd have to have the president's ear. He'd have to be rapture ready.
Oh, come on.
So I'm thinking Tom DeLay.
Oh, get out of here.
Pope.
Come on.
Pope Karen Hughes.
No.
Pope Ralph.
Oh, my God.
And if she weren't doing such an incredible job as Secretary of State, Pope Condi.
Oh, that's
Can't you just see her with the mitre and the incense and all?
Yeah, sure, why not?
Gorgeous.
Why not, Lawton? Hey, how about Pope Lawton Smalls while you're at it? He's picturing it. Get off it.
That's going to cut into my golf time, Mark. But thanks anyhow. You know, since we're kicking this around, I think we should just move the Vatican to Dallas.
Oh, God.
Just pick that sucker up and drop it right down next to Cowboys Stadium. I know some guys in Amarillo that can do that.
Oh,
it won't be a problem. They love the big hats in Texas. The Cardinals,
they're
just going to fit right in.
You're out of your
mind. Move it on over here.
You're out of your mind. So in your world, the neocons will absorb the Catholic Church and place it entirely under the control of a few American evangelicals.
Hey, that sounded pretty good. You're starting to think big now.
You know what I hate, Lawton? Listen to me. You know what I hate? The
crypto-fascist
zombie brigade tries to undermine anyone who disagrees with you. The press, the courts, the left, and now the Catholic Church. But stop it. I've got news for you. They're not going to choose an American pope. They're going to choose someone who opposes the excesses of the Bush administration neocon death cult. The Catholic Church is bigger and richer and better organized than you are, Lawton. You try to swallow them and you'll choke. You can't have everything, Lawton. It'll be fun watching the new pope stick at the Bush when he screws up. And he will, my friend. Yeah, that's it. Cry, you little girl.
Oh, we were this close to ruling the world. This close! Every time we get to the Vatican, bam! Gates slam in our faces.
Yeah,
those Catholic bastards have a 1,500-year head start on us. They were leading the Middle East way before we got to do it.
Yep.
So now, we just got to sit here while a bunch of European virgins in dresses pick the CEO of the world and we can't do nothing about it. Just have to sit here and be stupid. They got the whole world in their hands.
No, don't sing.
They got the whole world in their hands.
Come on, take
we
it easy. It's okay to lose. It's okay to lose sometimes. You know what I'm saying? It's okay to lose.
You don't get to pick the boat, but I wanted to.
It's okay, bud. It's all right. You all right? You okay? What's up?
Pope Trent Lott.
Oh, God.
Rupert Turner.
No!
Pope Karl Rove.
Oh, my God.
That would be a
demotion. Oh, no.
But,
you know what? I got a good idea. Goodbye, Lawton. Goodbye.
Right. God loves you.
Ugh.
Deal with it.
Oh, my God. Get off the phone. Get off!
All right.
Bye. Oh, my God. That's annoying.
Yeah.
I was kind of humored by him, though, this time around. I was a little humored by him. Well, we don't have much time to cover too much in this few minutes that we have, but I am kind of fascinated that the Air Genome Project that the Venter guy, J. Greg Venter, is going to set up a machine. They only did this once. Apparently, there's 1% of the microbes in the universe are cataloged, and he went and buried a microbe machine into the Sargasso Sea, and he found millions of new life forms, and now they're going to do it in the sky of New York.
Ooh.
They're going to start filtering. They're going to put a machine up and look for new microbes, new genetic strands in the air that you and I breathe every day, Riley, and that we breathe out. God knows what they're going to find, Riley.
Well, in New York, I can imagine.
Oh, my God, who knew that the air in New York might be the new primordial soup? Perhaps we'll see some interesting new flying animals. And what is that? Well, that's what happens when phlegm and subway grease.
Subway grease and grime and subway particles from the rails and all of that stuff, which is part and parcel of living in this particular urban environment. I'm scared of what they're going to find. time.
Don't you love it?
They may really find a new life form.
I think they will. It's probably, you know, stuck to the side of the top of the Empire State Building right now. Just
well, that's right down the block from here. They may be up in the air ducts in this elevated bunker we're in here.
Oh, let's go hunting. Let's go on a microbe safari after the show, Riley.
Let's
come on.
Let's
get your microbe net.
Let's go to Battery Park and, you know, go swimming or something.
All right. It's going to be nice today. We're going to come back. We got Jeff Daniels. He's going to sing some songs, talk about Woody Allen, whatnot.
And talk about his love for recreational vehicles.
Yes.
When we come back here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
And being afraid of life and being afraid of death, where the hell does that leave you?
The Mike Molloy Show on Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. Mark Maron here. It's me and Mark Riley.
Yes, it is.
Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. You know, sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So luckily, we have an iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator right here in the office to help us out, right here in the studio. Let's crank this baby up and feed it some headlines. All right, here we go. From the New York Times, black smoke signals second inconclusive vote at papal enclave. Let's feed that in there. Black smoke signals second inconclusive vote at papal. That's how you say it.
Papal
enclave. Translation, sequestered drunk cardinals burn another Vermeer. There you go. From the Washington Post, Armstrong to retire after this year's Tour de France. Put that in there, Armstrong to retire after this year's Tour de France. Translation, critics label Armstrong weak, quitter. From Reuters, women to give birth in art gallery. Women to give birth in art gallery. Translation, artist transitions into red period.
Oh.
Right now, it's my pleasure to bring on our interview that we did yesterday with Jeff Daniels, who is going to talk to us about many things. He'll be at Birdland tonight here in New York for two shows. Good morning, Jeff Daniels.
Morning.
Morning.
He's been in Terms of Endearment. He's been in Dumb and Dumber. He's been in the movie Bloodwork. He played a heavy. I saw you in The Hours. He played a gay man. You're a very versatile actor, my friend.
I've been all over the map in all characters, sexually. It's just been a great range to the career.
Now, his playing guitar and singing, I do stand-up and I do this, but I am a bedroom guitar player, and it's my secret dream. Was this your secret dream?
It always was. I've been playing for about 25, 30 years and writing songs. But I, you know, I never intended to come out of the closet with it, so to speak. I really didn't. I, you know, the last thing the world needs is another actor, singer, songwriter,
and, or even just a singer songwriter.
Well, maybe that, but, you know, or another actor. But it's just been fun. And I have a theater company back in Michigan where I live called the Purple Rose Theater Company, and they'd roll me out for four Christmas, New Year weeks in a row, 4 years of that, and we'd raise money, and so we recorded it and. You know, all the proceeds go to the theater company. It's a great way to raise money.
You said that, you know, something happened that led you down this path. What was the catalyst? I mean, what was it that finally made you say, okay, well, I'm going to start recording what I'm doing?
The fact that we needed to raise money for my theater company. And they literally, we had done the bowling event, we had done the golf outings, and now I said, why don't we push you out on stage with your guitar? Charge people money and see if they'll pay to see a train wreck. And the first year was exactly that. It was like, oh my God. I mean, I have a great admiration for guys who do stand up, you know, and guys who get out there or with just a guitar, no band around them.
I mean, train wreck's good theater sometimes.
Take off your clothes and walk on stage. Yeah. That's what it's like.
Yeah.
And, you know, you learn how to get better at it. So we recorded them, and a lot of the songs are funny, and it's done really well. We sell it pretty much off the website, jeffdaniels.com, and at Borders around the country. But it's done real well. We sold like 10,000 of them and raised some money.
It's kind of got a folk feel to it.
A lot of folk, a lot of comedy. I'm a big fan of guys like Loudon Wainwright and Stevie Goodman and Lyle Lovett and You know, guys like that, guys that have a kind of edge.
Let's talk about the state of theater and that, you know, you need to raise money for your theater. Is live theater in trouble? What are you doing at your theater? You know, does it, in general, you know, in New York, we, you know, there's plenty of it. But how does it go out where you live?
I think in a lot of ways it's tougher. No, it's tough in New York, too, because there are so many to raise, to get that fundraising dollar for the nonprofits is tough. I'll tell you the big, my big issue right now, a couple of them. One is the American theater has lost its sense of humor. The last time I looked, the Greeks were holding up two masks.
Yeah.
And at some point, and I think it was when television really kind of took off back in Milton Berle's day and all that stuff, the American theater got arrogant.
Uh-huh.
And elitist, and we do serious, meaningful, important work.
Hmm.
And comedies became a second-class citizen, and it's universal. All you got to do is look at the Oscars. Comedies are rarely.
It's hard to write a good comedy.
It's hard to do. So the other thing, though, that worries me right now is that as we all, after 9/11, as we all want to be safe, as we all want to be protected. That's filtered into the arts. We want our arts to be safe and pleasant and predictable, and we want to feel, we don't want to be disturbed, challenged, and you know
you need that though,
ripped on, yeah. You know, ripped, disturbed, mm-hmm. You know, and that hurts the American theater, that hurts the new American play, because people just want to be safe.
You're appearing tonight at Birdland, a jazz club here in Manhattan.
Yeah, no, you figure.
Yeah, I'm wondering, are you afraid that you're going to go out on stage and you're going to have an audience full of people that are going to expect you to play Night in Tunisia or something?
Very good. I need to know what key is that in and what's the first 27 chords in the first four bars. I played at Christine Lavin has been a huge friend and supporter of what I'm trying to do, and she pushed me on stage for an open mic night at the Birdland, like in February, and it went really well.
Oh, excellent.
You know, I played a song called "If William Shatner Can, I Can Too," and you know, it's very funny. And they invited me back. They said, "Come on in." And I'm going, well, I'm not the jazz guy. You know, Charlie Parker's going to roll over in his grave after my first song. And they're going, "We don't, you know, it's funny, and we want you in." So
and
it's going to be a good time.
And Charlie could use the exercise.
Well, probably. Yeah. Yeah.
So why don't we hear that? You were talking about you did a song, a political song. That it's a funny song shortly after the election. What was the story behind this tune?
Well, this was after the election, and I was, you know, like many people, kind of, you know, depressed. And I was really kind of ticked off about the marketing of Jesus and how we wrapped Jesus in a red, white, and blue robe. So I wrote a song called "St. Peter and the Neocon Christian at the Pearly Gates." I was sitting at a stoplight waiting for a sign, contemplating America's moral decline, reciting that scripture about an eye for an eye. Never saw that sanitation truck, and he sure didn't see me, gosh darn the look. I guess even the good have to die. See, I've spent my life as a neocon Christian, pounding down doors for countless coalitions, doing all I could to bring America back to God, where right is right and the left is wrong, where you gotta believe if you're gonna belong, where some of us are even and the rest are just odd. I put on my red tie, tuck in my white shirt. My navy blue blazer is ready to go. Red, white, and blue. Jesus loves me too. Tell the Lord God Almighty, I'm coming home. At the pearly gates, I met St. Peter. He shook my hand like a well-paid greeter. Slapped me on the back, said, "Happy Judgment Day." He said, "We got a long line of people waiting, but for you, it's going to be no hesitating. Because the Lord wants to see you right away." I said, "Pete, I sure wouldn't mind an angel escort. Maybe Gabriel's trumpet, a little hallelujah chorus. played in a key where if God wants, he can sing along. Now I'm going to need a pair of wings in size XXL and a seat right next to the man himself, because I got to be in his ear for eternal life if we're going to fix what's wrong. And Pete said, well, guys in the middle of wrapping up a breakfast meeting with Mother Teresa, Buddha, and even Gandhi's eating. Muhammad, Moses, and Hare Krishna went back for a second plate. Pete said, all I know is there's lots of laughter. Not quite sure if it was before or after. Jesus said, I hear the second coming's out at the gate. Take off that red tie. Take off that white shirt. And leave that navy blue blazer behind. Red, white, and blue may mean a lot to you, but the Lord God Almighty, I hate to tell you, the Lord God Almighty, at least in my Bible, the Lord God Almighty, he's colorblind.
Nice. All right, very nice.
Thank you very much.
That's Jeff Daniels from an interview and a conversation we had with him yesterday. And when we come back, we'll have more of that. He's going to talk a little bit about Clint Eastwood, Woody Allen, some of the movies he's done, and I think even sing a bit more. It's 44 yeah. past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
See if you qualify to dramatically reduce your tax debt. Call 800-661-0491 right now. That's 800-661-0491. Call right now.
Past the hour, it's Landesting. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. We continue now with our conversation with Jeff Daniels that we had yesterday. He will be appearing at Birdland tonight for two shows.
So you're going to quit acting now or just...
No. No, this is all... I mean, it's so nice of you guys to have me, and we've bumped around in some other national things. It's just kind of exploded, and... We just it was just set out to raise some money for the theater company. It went from local to regional to national. So it's, you know, it's a good time.
So you're going to be at Birdland tonight here in New York City. Two shows, 9 and 11.
That's right.
So, okay, let's talk about films for just a second, because you've worked with some of my favorite directors. You've worked with great directors, Woody Allen, Clint Eastwood. You played a psychopath. Very good.
Thank you.
The Farrelly Brothers, James Brooks, and numerous other ones. Now, who's your favorite to work with? I know that's probably a difficult question, but what was it like to, let's go, how about differences? Like, how, in style, Woody Allen and, say, Clint Eastwood?
Everybody you mentioned, I would gladly work with again. I mean, they were all good because they were all the best. They're all the best in the business, mm-hmm. and it just becomes about... you know, what they're looking for. The commonality, what's common between all of them, Robert Altman's another one, is they really give it to you. They really let you do it. I mean, it's less direction. They kind of want to see what you came up with, and then they kind of mold that. Clint's like that. Woody is like that. Jonathan Demme is like that.
So once they know that you've got a hand, oh, that's right, Something Wild.
You're supposed to be
good. Was
that
your first movie? Something Wild?
No, I was like number four or five, something like that.
Wow, I forgot about that one. So once you come to the table with your character, they're like, all right, go.
Show me what you brought. Yeah, and that's a great way. You come in and you kind of throw it at the lens, and then Woody will step in, or Jonathan Demme, whomever, will step in and go, okay, great, now they got something to work with. It's like writing, you know. You can't rewrite a blank page. So my job is to kind of come in and here's what I think it is. And if you're right on the money... Then great. Then they go, great, let's shoot it. And then they kind of fine-tune. That's what the best in the business do.
Now, do you find roles, do you find that you're offered roles that you just can't connect with on one level or another?
I haven't, but that's partly, you know, the range helps. And I think there's a kind of bipolar schizophrenic thing that happens, you know. It really is. You kind of become that other person. You play the little game in your head that, you know, you didn't end up being, you know, me.
Right.
In 2005, when you were 18, you took a different path, and you ended up being that guy. So it's all just, it's, you know, therapists would have a field day with me, but then I wouldn't have a career, so I can't do therapy.
So now,
before you worked with Clint Eastwood, he was one of your favorite directors, and then you got a phone call from Clint Eastwood, and you actually wrote a song that's on the album that is available, Jeff Daniels Live and Unplugged, to benefit the Purple Rose Theater at jeffdaniels.com, yes?
Yes.
And you wrote a song about Clint Eastwood. Can we hear it?
Yes. I mean, for every actor, it's a great honor to get shot and killed by Clint Eastwood. And being the killer, serial killer in the movie, it was just, I couldn't, it was a great night when...
Blood work, yeah.
When he just, for those who haven't seen it, I just ruined it. But I, you know, so I wrote this song called The Dirty Harry Blues. Well, I've had more than my share brushes with greatness, but with all humility, I would have to rate this. It's the biggest of the big, the best of them all. Oh, my dream came true with a little telephone call. And the end of my life, no joking, was the good, the bad, the ugly, the king of the unspoken. Make my day, blow me away, got them dirty hairy blues. He said, got this little project, got this little part about a serial killer with a cold heart. I said, Mr. Eastwood, I'd be so honored to play a bad guy. The only thing that'd make it better would be if I got to die. He said, well, if I had to guess off the top of my head, when all's said and done, one of us is going to be dead. Make my day, well, here we got there. Dirty Harry Blues. 30-30, 44, pull that trigger, Clint, give me what for. I'm a wanted man, dead or alive. I don't give a damn if it was 6 shots or 5. Clint, what is up with the no-talking, man? I mean, what do we do when you're a remake of Dead Man Walking? I can see the headlines now. Actor goes out to Hollywood, makes a movie with Clint Eastwood, and dies. Maybe I should call my wife and kids, say my goodbyes, right? Clint? Clint? Well, the sound man said, we're rolling. Props gave him his gun. Someone yelled, action. Take one. He slipped off his shades. He squinted those eyes. I tried to tell the truth, but all that came out were lies. I said my final line. Clint said his. He cocked back that hammer like he wasn't gonna miss. Now I want to cry like a baby. I want to squeal like a pig. Roasting like a marshmallow at the end of his twig. I was shaking like a leaf when his upper lip curled. When he pulled that trigger, and I was leaving this world. I thought, wait a minute, to hell with the Oscar, the Academy. That little gold statue will be wasted on me, cause my dream came true out in Hollywood. When I got killed by Clint Eastwood, make my day, blow me away, goddamn dirty Harry. Make my day, blow me away, goddamn dirty Harry. Make my day, blow me away, goddamn dirty Harry. Thank you very much.
Nice. Jeff Daniels is with us. He's in town tonight at Birdland for 2 shows, 9 and 11 o'clock. So out of all the characters you played, what's the one that most people remember you on the street for? What do they come up and say to your face?
I loved when you sat on the toilet and Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah, is it true?
Yeah.
I would be Dumb and Dumber. Somehow
it's going to be on the tombstone, and that's okay, damn it. That's all right. No, I love that movie. I loved making it. Loved working with Jim. You know, we were childish, immature, and irresponsible, and we got paid for it, you know. And it makes people laugh. It really does.
Well, we really appreciate you coming down here and playing for us, and great luck with the show tonight, and good luck with the record. Jeff Daniels, Live and Unplugged, to benefit the Purple Rose Theater, available at jeffdaniels.com. You can probably get it at morningsedition.com. We'll link you up with that. And also tonight, if you're in New York City, Birdland, 2 shows, 9 o'clock and 11. Have a great day, man, and good show tonight.
Thank you.
That was Jeff Daniels, and, well, that was kind of fun, actually.
Yeah, it was.
Well, hey, there's the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Write these down, kids. One, urge the College of Cardinals to reform the Pope's selection process. Black smoke equals dangerous carcinogens. Two, protest title of Broadway musical Spamalot. Canned meat is still murder, people. Three, it's spring allergy season. Protest antihistamine medication. Pollen genocide is still genocide, friends. Four, support anti-piracy bill for protecting the rights of artists. Then burn a copy of your friend's Hotel Rwanda DVD, but just to help spread the word. Five, today's phrase, just drop this in the conversation. You know why Lance Armstrong is retiring, don't you? The oil companies are pushing him out, man. Too many bikes are bad for business. Wake up, sheeple. They want to keep you in chains.
Look out.
Oh, that was a good show, Riley.
It was a good show. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking with Dan Cloris.
About the movie about Emil Griffith.
Yes, about Emil Griffith and about a really, really deep time in American boxing history.
Okay, man. Good show, buddy.
Good show. Tomorrow, we'll see you, Air America Radio.